Okay, we begin the questions. A question on how refined should the practice of being sensitive to the entire body? How refined should be the practice of being sensitive to the entire body? Say, should I be able to sense my earlobe or liver? I find it hard to sense the body when it gets calm. Is it normal or is it a lack of discernment? One needs to be sensitive enough to have mindfulness and composure. I mean, it doesn't have to be astoundingly refined, but it's more you're using the body as a base and anchor in order to have a foundation of clarity and an ability to reflect, because it's not if for some reason it's maybe not interesting is a good word, or useful to explore a degree of refinement in the sense that it brightens the mind or energizes the mind or gives a different perspective that's helpful, that's okay. But if it's just to satisfy one's obsessive tendencies, that's probably not a good thing to be doing. Okay, it's my first time listening to Ajahn Yaniko. What have you done to him, Lumpo? I assume that's a good thing. Okay. Would you say more about the meaning of merit, punya? That's actually correct spelling. I think you said in Pali. Are there other words or definitions in English? Thanks again for your teachings. It is a bit difficult. Maybe blessings is something like that. Punya is. It's skillful, wholesome action that ripens in happiness and well-being. So it's a particularly that's maybe a way of saying it. Although there's wholesome and skillful are used in other contexts as well, laid out what the bases of punya are, then generosity, virtue, mental cultivation, and then things like service and humility, delighting or in the goodness that others do, and that sense of anumodana, when one delights in, see somebody doing something, when you delight in their goodness, and that's a great way of making merit. You don't even have to do anything, you just watch others. And then dedicating the merit of one's own good actions and dedicating that for the benefit of others, listening to Dhamma, teaching Dhamma, or giving advice in Dhamma, and the last one is straightening one's views. That shifting one's views to right view and views that align with the Buddha. Okay, find the mind especially distractible during meal times. Partly this reflects long-standing habits of talking, reading, listening to news, etc. while eating. In the retreat context, it's also due to the heightened, quote-unquote, social aspect of mealtime, even though in silence. Can you give some suggestions for staying more present and mindful while eating? Deep bow of gratitude for your wonderful teachings. One, I think, is just recognizing that by its nature, eating is going to, and meal times are going to be a particularly vulnerable time for the mind to be distracted. And on a retreat time, it's about the only thing to look forward to. And then, of course, there is a certain containment in the meditation hall, although one is with other people. But in the meal setting, then, you know, there's some movement and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, it's natural that there's going to be an inclination to more distraction. So that factoring that in is important. So that rather than coming from an ideal of, oh, I should be mindful and composed and settled at all times, it's sort of saying, oh, meal times are, you know, they really grab my attention. And then, okay, how do I work with that? So then finding an object of meditation or object of attention within oneself, okay, paying attention to that bodily presence, feeling of contact, say with the touch of the floor, grounding one's attention in that, observing the way that the mind is attracted to the food, but then sort of looking at, oh, look at that. It's actually, all I'm seeing is color, but it has a different meaning. So, just sort of analyzing or reflecting of the experience and what we build into a distraction. So then it's, you start to learn that process of how that works. And then then you can take that back for reflection. Another thing is just finding if you find that after having received one's food, finding a quiet place that's away from the others, and have the meal a bit more separated so it has less impact. So there's different ways of working with it, but I think one of the main things is really giving oneself the opportunity to investigate and contemplate, oh, how's that process work? Because you really learn something through that. You know, the nature of... when the Buddha talks about, say, different nutriments, one is the actual nutriment of physical food, but then the others are more mental nutriments. But that first one, the Buddha says, when one understands the nature, say, food as a nutriment, one understands the five strands of sense pleasure or sense desire. The nature of sense desire is understood by when one understands food as a nutriment, so that one's reflected on the effect that it has on the mind, and how external objects impact the internal process of our desire and attachment structures. A Buddhist teacher explains, as I understand it, that the first three factors of enlightenment causes, and the last four are the last three factors of enlightenment, or the bojangas that Ajahn Nyanikot brought up today, are causes, and the last four are the effects, and that as meditation practitioners, therefore, work on the first three with right view, and the last four will follow in time. Please comment. I mean, it's one way of looking at it. The Buddha, I mean, the Buddha talked about it in many different ways, one of the ways that he talked about it are that three are more kind of active and activating factors, and three are more calming or settling factors, and we use them differently. And he gives the, in the sense that investigation of dhammas, effort, piti, joy, are kind of the active factors, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity are more the settling factors, are the calming factors, and they're used in different circumstances. Mindfulness is always used. You're always applying mindfulness, whatever. And the image that the Buddha gives is it's as if one has a, you know, if the if you have a fire, and then you throw on a whole bunch of dry wood and grass and twigs, then the fire is going to flare up even more. But if you've got a fire and it's sort of getting under control, you put on a bunch of wet branches, lots of green leaves, and all sorts of duff and whatnot, and it's going to bring the fire down, which is what one would want. So and then the Buddha compares it to the mind, in the sense that if the mind is kind of agitated and unsettled, then that isn't the time to be putting more effort in doing the investigation of dhammas. Arousing joy. It's more appropriate to be putting in the aspects of tranquility, settled, the samadhi factors, equanimity, and that's a balancing a quality. And then, of course, the opposite is true as well. If one is, you know, one has some a diddly little fire that's going out, then you want to be throwing on dry branches and to build it up, and you don't want to be throwing on the kind of the wet leaves and whatnot. So they're balancing factors they're all causal factors that are applied in the appropriate circumstances for the mind. It's all written in Thai, so I have to translate it as I go. So, this is a question around a stream entry. What is a stream enterer? So that it's the first level of awakening. There's four levels: stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and arhant, fully enlightened being. And it's one of the qualities of a stream enterer is that it's irreversible, and that's what this it is. Taking one to Nibbana, if not in this lifetime, then at the very least, or the very most. The slowest stream enterer will still realize full enlightenment within seven lifetimes. So it's a irreversible process. The pull is too strong. One's seen something that one can't ignore. Then there's a question around I think within most of there's a question: is there anybody, lay person who attains stream entry and stays as a lay person, and that is very common in the scriptures. There's many famous stream enterers: Anathapindika, Visakha. They're considered great disciples. On the male and female side of the lay people, and great supporters of the Buddha, King Bimbisara. Those are very famous, and as well as that, that they're within the scriptures, it's not an unordinary thing for the lay people. In large numbers, realizing stream entry, continuing to live in the world, and maintaining a household, so that that's. That's certainly a model, and I think that's something that is I think it's important, and it's one of the things that tried to convey in the book The Island, that's not an unrealistic aspiration on anybody's part to be setting that as a goal, and trying to put forth the appropriate effort and exploration toward that purpose. Okay, regarding yesterday's teaching that rebirth is happening every moment, could you give instructions how to discern the preceding step, becoming? And that's bhava, as opposed to, in here is bhavanga, which is a different state. And bhava is becoming. Would you consider transition from sleep into awakened state being a quote-unquote rebirth, and whether there is becoming manifesting upon waking up? Just the whole aspect of becoming is the just the mind moving forward, and with that movement forward, of course, it's conceiving of itself as a being that is taking on identity and with all the attendant preferences and pushes and pulls within the heart. So it's something very ordinary and it's happening all the time. And that's the sort of process of becoming and birth is happening. It's happening all the time, but when we're making it conscious, and it's the way I've looked at it, that sense of that feeling of movement and just that pull towards an identity, a being, a becoming, reaffirmation of ourselves as a individual being. It's a becoming. This is a question. I think must be from a Thai person also. Do the monks at Wat Bapong chant the Jinabanchon, which is a... and then would you show us how to chant the Jinabanchon? It's a very famous, popular chant in Thailand. And they don't at Wat Bapong. It's not a part of the normal chants. It's a chant that was popularized by a monk in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Very, very famous monk, as Somdet Do, and he popularized that chant. And if you ever think that Theravadins are kind of stodgy, narrow, kind of teeny vehicle. pick up the Jina Banchara chant, and it's a real it's a tantric chant. It's a Vajrayana perspective in a Theravada framework, because what you're doing is a visualization. What you're doing is a chant that is a visualization of all of the with the Buddha at the center. But then what you're doing is surrounding yourself completely with all of the great enlightened disciples, and you've got. I don't know the chant, but it's, you got Sariputta on the shoulder, and you got people on your back. You just, it's just
Rahula hanging off my neck.
Yeah. So it's this wonderful visualization, and it means victory. What's the
Chinna? Ajahn Jeff translates it as the victor's cage, but sometimes it's like the victor's mansion or the victor's cage.
What you're doing is creating a mansion or a cage of all these great beings around you, and it's a protection and a blessing chant that you do. So in Thai culture, in Thai tradition, it's chanted all through the country by mostly, well, monks and lay people. But Wat Bopong, it's not popular. But it is, it's in, if anybody wants to look it up, it is. It's in the, say, Access the Insight website of the Dhammayutta Order chanting book. And then, look up the Victor's Cage. When it's chanted, it's actually very beautiful as well. The Pali is very beautiful. Okay. I have an autoimmune disorder of undiagnosed origin. I was wondering if it was worth this precious time of practice to send metta and thoughts of healing to the body. If so, how do you recommend approaching it? Also, is this compatible with seeing this ailment as a heavenly messenger and contemplation of the body's demise? As symptom might reduce it to a mild physical irritation, should I also contemplate unpleasant feeling? Or is it best to just stay grounded in the breath and metta and not risk proliferation? Oh, it's always, I mean, that's always helpful to in terms of paying attention to the level of proliferation. Practicing metta is always helpful. It's always beneficial. And if the thoughts of healing to the body are useful, both in terms of physically and mentally, then it certainly should be done. And particularly, say, one can still view an ailment as a heavenly messenger and hope that it goes away as well, or or hope that it allays it, so that those are they're not at odds with each other. It's like when you contemplate, I'm of the nature to age, I've not gone beyond age, I'm nature sick, I've not gone beyond sickness, I'm nature to die, I've not gone beyond death. But then, say as monastics, then we contemplate the four requisites. One of the requisites is medicine to take when we're ill. And in order to look after the body, to heal illnesses when we have them, too. Try to provide a basic a foundation of well-being, energy. It's actually one of the in a couple of discourses, the Buddha points to good health as a factor of a support and aid for one's practice, so that not having too many physical ailments that obstruct one's mental well-being, but then also obstructing one's actual life force, so that one is able to contemplate the body's demise, but one doesn't have to hasten it. You want to be looking after that the physical well-being, to the extent that one is giving oneself sufficient energy and well-being to contemplate and reflect on the teachings. Metta is always useful. Okay, no question, but a comment. Thank you so much, Rinpo, for reminding us that chanting is also listening and paying attention. Be mindful while we are chanting. I noticed that when we were chanting at a fast pace, several people wouldn't be able to follow. Many of us are not familiar with Pali, or not familiar with Pali when written in English, and low, light, small print. some of us might just need a little more time. So thank you. Okay. Is it a good remedy to sit with eyes open when afflicted with sloth and torpor? Standing? Any other ideas? Certainly opening one's eyes is important when sloth and torpor is present. Of course, it's also that sometimes with sloth and torpor, then it creeps up on one when one's eyes are closed. And then it's I don't really notice it sometimes. So then that's where it's important to like using the physical posture so that one, it's sort of energizing the system, but then it's also it's a bit more noticeable when if the posture shifts. One can start making assumptions that, okay, I'm drifting here. So the sloth and torpor is starting to creep in. The use of like a recitation, like Buddho or reciting the refuges, Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami. So I'm giving the mind something to do. That's one of the, with sloth and torpor, we want to give the mind enough work so that it can engage itself in the activity of the meditation. If it's a bit too diffuse and ill-defined, then it's easy for the mind to drift off. So that giving it a bit more work to do. Visualizations of opening one's eyes, but then also it's just that bringing. That image or perception of light into the mind, into the body, letting that perception of light kind of create some space and energy, using mudras. Of you, just the way that one places one's hands, so sitting sometimes rather than sitting comfortably like this, just holding a mudra like that, and then even lifting the hands up a bit. If one's really kind of sleepy and drowsy, then just hold, where one has to hold the hands up like this, there's a conscious effort that's needed, and it's usually enough to again, it's sort of a way to engage the mind and one's energy that is you know, it's subtle, but it's enough to keep the mind alert. And then if it's really quite strong, overwhelming, standing is a viable posture for meditation. Just actual standing, standing up at one's place, standing up off to the side. Less chance of really drifting off if you're standing. You have to actually pay attention to your balance in posture, so that it tends to wake one up. So those are all useful things to experiment with. Okay. Easy one. What is the English translation of the mealtime blessing? It is an acknowledgement of the generosity that has been done, the good action in terms of the meal offering, the giving of food, and then taking delight in that that offering, that good wholesome kamma, that action, and then setting forth a wish that by the power of that good action, may you be free, may you have long life, happiness, well-being, strength, good health, all of those, all sorts of good things. And then the last chant that we do is through the power of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, it's three verses. May the devas protect you, may all good fortune come to you. So it's us acknowledging the goodness that's done and setting forth a kind of an intention, a hope that you receive the fruits of and it's actually called an anamotana chant, in the sense that one is delight. Anamota means to delight in the goodness that's done, so that we're delighting in the goodness that's done, and also bringing to mind that is the natural result of that goodness. So far, there's not any really good English translations that don't sound hokey. The last 2-3:30 sittings have been challenging. Restless body and proliferating mind. I guess it's my time of day for anxiety. I use several techniques, metta, 32 body parts, watching my long breaths, and by the time the bell rang, my internal landscape had changed. Thank you all for your teachings. Now my question. I'm still very attached to my husband and children. I don't want to relinquish the intimacy I share with husband. I will suffer when they are gone. How to reconcile this practice of relinquishment with the reality that I am a wife, mother, and householder? I think one of the things is just that the when there is an acknowledgement of on both sides. It's sort of, I think one of the things that the practice does is allows us to have space for all these different feelings, reactions, emotions, and put them into context. And it isn't coming from an idealized version of everybody should take relinquishment to the point of going off and ordaining. It's more like, no, the relinquishment is actually a skillful acknowledgement of the areas where we do create suffering, and our suffering is it can be allayed and can be put into perspective, so that we understand its nature, and we don't create a problem around it. I think one of the things that comes to mind is, in Buddhist cultures, especially the Theravada cultures, one of the lay women who is exalted and looked up to is Visakha, and she's a stream enterer, so obviously had insight into Dhamma, and she had that at quite a young age, had that insight, had that knowledge at quite a young age, and she went on to have a husband and 20 children. That's especially in Indian culture, that's considered really a good thing. So it's sort of this is, but raised family, but that it was, you know, held in a different way, and obviously there's a the vagaries of existence are still there, but it's held in a different way, so that relinquishment doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, a pushing away. It's an ability to set down the sticky bits that create suffering and complication, and that's what we have to pay attention to, because when we keep doing that, then we're actually able to individually, of course, to live with a stability and well-being, but then also we live with others in a way that is, it's not creating complications and difficulties for them as well, so that practice of the Dhamma and the ability to see clearly the nature of suffering allows us to not get entangled in the things that you know really create problems in the human condition. We need more people like that. Yeah, I think of some of that, that I say, like in families that grow up with really strong spiritual models. It's just an incredible blessing. Okay. My relationship with my kids, this is apropos of the previous answer, actually. My relationship with my kids can be so contentious and draining, so different than I thought it would be. How can I love and train them even though it seems they were born to resisting these things? Exactly. It's like Ajahn Chah had the saying, you know what, how we create suffering, going into the village. Of course, this is a very rural village, and then seeing ducks and seeing chickens, and most people know the story, but start kind of proliferating around you. These chickens, they can run fast, and they can, they've got some useful things. They crow in the morning, wake you up, and start the day with that. But the ducks, they can't walk very good. They don't even sound very nice. Whack, whack, whack. Yeah. Why aren't ducks more like chickens? ducks should really be more like chickens. that's the problem of human existence. trying to make ducks like chickens. Trying to make your kids like they should be. Well, good luck. Okay. Although in reasonable condition, I'm realizing that fear/anxiety of death/non-becoming is pervasive in the background of my daily life. Does the Buddha speak to that which continues after the body dies? Other than the five recollections and contemplating impermanence, does he offer guidance on how to best prepare to greet one's death? Thank you so much. Signed, here today, gone tomorrow? ? If we're kind of a sensitive human being, it's a reasonable thing to be fear, anxiety. Around death and the ending of one's life. It's sort of this really is an unstable condition, and even if one is in reasonable condition, the possibilities of things can happen are way beyond what reason can conjure up. I think it's very, very natural. And of course, the Buddha, in all through the canon, the scriptures, and he speaks of the that continuity of after death, that the there is this continuum that seeks another becoming, another birth, in some way, shape, or form. Of course, it's conditioned by the state and quality of our heart, of our mind, and the mind stream, and the best preparation, mindfulness, clear comprehension, besides the contemplating impermanence and five recollections, those are more arousing urgency. But one also, just the sense of investigating the nature of the body gives a sense of of dispassion, of cooling. Settling, that's helpful, but then also the meditations on loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, the divine abidings are really important to bring a sense of possibility to the spaciousness of the and brightness of the of the of the heart, the recollections of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, recollections of generosity, virtue, as I mentioned the other day, the devas. What it is, a contemplation on the action that one has done. It's not different from the actions that have been the cause for these beings to be born in fortunate circumstances. One's looking at qualities that looking at contemplations and investigations that develop the mind, both in terms of wholesome, bright qualities, as well as that sense of urgency and a sense of dispassion. So it's one needs a balance, and that's where there's a set of practices that is given that are called the protective meditations, and there are four different practices that they're providing a balance so that on the urgency side, then there's the contemplations of the body. And then in Sankayakata Sati, and then Asubhagamatthana, the contemplations on the unattractive nature of the body. But then on the other side, then there's Buddhano Sati, recollections of the Buddha, and then Metta Bhavana, the contemplations of and cultivation of loving kindness, so that it's these are you have a balance there that is you're applying it to the mind to help the mind be as steady and clear as possible, because it's similar with in one of the earlier questions of the factors of enlightenment, awakening. You know, there's the kind of the active ones, but then there's the settling ones, and you have to learn how to apply them in the appropriate time and circumstance and skill, so that there's a balance that's being created. That's, I mean, you know, comes back to that phrase that I've used many times now, that okay, it's just right, and that sense in Thai is a padi. It's just, yeah, it's just right. That's one of the teachings of one of Ajahn Chah's teachers. He didn't talk a lot. He didn't give extensive instructions all the time. But that was actually something that he kept referring to. The nature of this just right quality of the Dhamma, and just saying, you know, the Dhamma is neither. Neither tall or short, neither long, tall or short, neither white or black, short and long, taller and, but it, you know, all these different things, opposites. He said, it's just right. So that in Thai it rhymes, which is often bo sung bo dum bo dum bo kao bo yao bo san po di po di. So paying attention to those qualities of just right. That's a real preparation for death. Can you please talk a bit about samatha meditation and its uses for calming a very agitated or restless mind, and how one might go about finding a quote-unquote disc of earth? That's this one of the kasinas, meditation objects that are described as a part of samatha practice, or an object of suitable color. Do they sell these somewhere? Amazon, you know. Thank you for your explanation. Yeah, well, you can use things that are easily to hand in terms of if one's using, because what one's doing is taking, and this is a particular kind of practice that are. Settling, or their tranquility practice, or settling practices, they tend. Mindfulness of breathing, it can be considered both a samatha practice, a settling practice, as well as a investigative insight practice. But some of the things that say just easily to hand, just like using a stick of incense. And you've got a tiny little red sort of dot at the end of the incense, and using that as an object to gaze at, to look at, to use as setting it in front of one. Of course, it's you're not in the hall here, but if you're at home, that's an easy. A visual object that one can pay attention to. Sometimes a candle is wavering. If it's very it's not, if there's not a lot of air movement, and you can use a candle. Using a some kind of a like a small vessel. Like one of the things the monks would use would be that just their bowl lids, and then filling that with water, clear water, and then you use a water casino, and you can be doing that. Using a disc of color is easy to do, like making a disc about this big, you can make yourself. But it has to be quite smooth. I mean, in the sense of the color needs to be, you can't just sort of slap on a bunch of paint, and shouldn't have light. It should be very smooth, because the mind will go to the striations or the marks. It's just the nature of the mind, so it starts to settle. It starts taking in more detail, and it'll be those are easy to do. Just sort of sitting outside, and it's easy to do in California, and especially in the summertime, just sitting outside and looking at the sky, no clouds. The space element is by Giri, especially with you got slope. We got slopes, and we got sky. You can be. Okay, I'm wondering if the Buddha spoke about what part of us reincarnates. Is it possible to remember our past lives? Five khandhas. Same five khandhas. In the sense, well, I mean, your physical body passes away, but it's the feeling of, how do you say, identification with body is still there. It seeks another body. But then the feeling, perception, mental formations, conscious, the same five khandhas. It's not, how do you say, it's a lot of the same stuff over and over again. And then it is possible for some people to remember their past lives, either through spontaneous recollection or through cultivation. And there's actual practices that are laid out for how to remember past lives. So that's a possibility within the mind. But I can't do a lot of things. like perception seeing devas or ghosts or whatever. I don't see any of that. I lived at Wat Nanachat for years, and I got to know where all the different kind of ghosts lived, because I lived there for many years. Then I was the abbot for 15 years, and you start hearing the same story years apart from different people from different countries. And he's like, okay, well, maybe there's something to that. But personally, they don't talk to me. It was really funny. There was one time a person came to me and said, and they'd only just recently come to the monastery. And they said, Ajahn, I've got this. And she's a bit nervous. I said, I've got this very strange request. And I don't know, what you think of this, but it was a very tentative But I saw this being, and you know, over in such and such an area of the monastery, and they asked if you would dedicate merit for them, because they know that you don't. You can't you know, pay attention to them or something. I can't remember how it was put. It's just too thick to get it. That's my limitations. Okay, the other day when I was meditating, my heart started beating very fast. Then I got really cold, and my body started shivering. I started breathing very deep to calm the body down, but still couldn't control the shaking. At times like this, is it better to stop and take care of the body, or keep meditating through it? That's a very subjective call, in the sense that I don't think there's any, you know, right way to say. I think one of the things is you know, establishing that, you know, returning to that mindfulness, returning to the breath, trying to calm the breath as best one can. And then get a feel for what feels appropriate, because that sometimes it's too overwhelming just to stay with it, and one shouldn't feel, you know, tremendously obligated because it's because of some idealized version that you have of yourself as a meditator, but should be willing to. Kind of adapt take in the circumstances with as much mindfulness and kindness as possible. Okay, we're getting through these. Can you provide a reference as to where this printed version of the 16th stage of Anapanasati comes from? Author, translation, publication. This just comes from Access to Insight website. It's the translator is Ajahn Jeff, and it's a how do you say it? It's an excerpt from the Anapanasati Sutta Majjhima 1:18. Okay, this is using Indian classification, Hindu classification, I think. The delusional vata quality of mind has grown stronger as I have aged. I can space out now like never before. Do you have suggestions for cutting through this spacey delusion? I'm more familiar with bitta aversion, so looking for ways to work skillfully with vata. What was he talking about? Yeah, I mean, it's, I can appreciate the aging process. The thing is really trying to get ones. That's why I always put in a plug in for mindfulness of the body, because it's tangible. It's got a, you've got an anchor. It's solid. It has the ability to ground us, and that's extremely helpful in all sorts of ways. And I think in particular with that sense of that keeping the mind from floating off too much into that kind of spacey, delusional areas. Okay. Maybe we can do this for our chanting. That's a dedication to Brendan Tennefoss. May you have happiness and its causes.